Ladies and gentlemen, President Bill Clinton.
Thank you very much, and please be seated. In keeping with our tradition, the closing plenary will largely be devoted to hearing from the four chairs of our working groups to talk about what you did, all of you together. We'll learn some more about the commitments our members have made and about looking ahead. I have gotten out among you and talked to as many people as I could, particularly people who've been involved in all three of these, and the consensus that I got was that this was the best one so far. And I thank you all. I'll say more about what was different and where we're going in a moment, but so many people told me that they love the plenary sessions, they love the opening, they love Bishop Tutu, but what they got the most out of was the small meetings and sitting around the table, talking with others, getting ideas and figuring out what to do. And one of the things that I noticed just in the commitments that I announced this time is that we had many more commitments that obviously grew out of relationships that came out of this meeting involving much larger numbers of people in one project working together. And that's one of the things that I hoped would happen. We also had, and I'll say more about this later, a huge number of people that took in the CGI this year over the internet. This has become what I hoped it would be, an action-forcing event with a lot of ideas, not just responding to problems, but coming up with ideas about how to change the playing field for the future. I'd like to just get right to the meat of the coconut now with the reports, beginning with Gene Sperling to tell us about the work of the education track. So, Gene, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. President. I could not start without first thanking not only the amazing people who've run the entire Clinton Global Initiative, but in particular, my deputies, Michelle Jolin, Brian Deese, and Mr. President Justin Van Fleet, the deputy who did the most work, was hospitalized on Friday. He broke his heart not to be here, and he came. We sent him a car. He came with his mom. He got here this morning, and we're very thankful that he could make it for part of this. Mr. President, perhaps the main reason, I think, that education sometimes does not get the attention it deserves as a silent crisis is perhaps because there was never that specific moment when a CNN camera can capture a child dying from lack of education. And yet we know, make no mistake about it, that children die every day from a lack of education. We know that every year of education a future mother has reduces the chance of infant mortality by 10%. We know a child born to a mother with at least 5 years of education in Africa has a 50% greater chance of reaching the age of five. We know that a 16-year-old girl who goes to school has a 3 to 6 times less chance of contracting HIV/AIDS than a girl who has never gone to school. And yet, what inspires us and inspires the people who came to the education track is not that education is life-saving, but that it is life-enhancing, that it is the foundation for all of the development issues that we care about. It is the foundation of healthier families, higher wages, better democracy. And there's something else special about education. There is always a danger when we speak here in New York, in Washington, of extreme poverty. There's always a danger to start seeing the people we're talking about as victims, destitute victims who need a dollar a day simply to survive, to get by. That is not a problem in education. As you know, Mr. President, you walk into the poorest school in the poorest part of the world, and you ask children what they want to be, and the hands are up, the hopes are high. They want to be doctors, they want to be teachers, they want to be heads of state. When we see those children, we don't see victims. We see our own children. I see my son Miles in the eyes of the children that I meet in those schools. Mr. President, I was very proud in 2000 when you and then First Lady Clinton sent me to Dakar to represent you and agree to what became the Millennium Development Goal for Education, that we would reach universal primary education by 2015. Now, to be very candid, and we've been candid throughout, the goal for education is of universal primary education by 2015 is probably the world's most ambitious and pathetic goal. It is ambitious because today as we speak, there will be 80 million children under the age of 12 who will not see the inside of a schoolroom this year, who will not have to complain about too much homework or hope for a sick day. There are probably another 250 million children who will not see a secondary school this year. And in Africa, as many as 50% of girls will not complete primary education. So it is ambitious. And yet it is in some ways a pathetic goal, because when I walk into a classroom anywhere in the world and tell people that that's the goal, every child's reaction is the same. Why only primary, and why are you waiting to 2015? That's why in our first panel, Mr. President, we didn't just focus on girls' education. We focused on girls getting into secondary school. We heard from the founder of BRAC that even though he planned to just do primary education, that 94% of the girls who completed demanded going to secondary school. We talked of the security issues from the minister of Afghanistan, of making girls' education safe. It's still in Afghanistan and the threat we still see from the terrorists. We heard constantly about the importance of girl-friendly schools, of making sure there's privacy, that the schools are close by, that there are female teachers, and that there are just simple things like latrines that would not prevent a girl from wanting to go to school for fear of ridicule. And we heard constantly two other things. We heard about the economic incentive, that you have to have the incentive to convince the young woman and the parents who often make the choice that there is a reason that even though you need that girl's help when you're in extreme poverty for water, for firewood, for care, that there's a reason, there's an economic incentive to make the sacrifice for the future to have her go to school. And we heard, of course, about the economic barriers, the need for scholarships, and the need to make school free. Now, Mr. President, if you had asked, or someone were to ask, give somebody the devilish assignment of trying to design an education financing system where your goal was to exclude the most vulnerable and disadvantaged children, you could not come up with a better system than charging a fee per child for every child who wants to go to school. Because for families, as they put each child and the cost of going to public school becomes higher and higher, who do you think they exclude? Not the oldest boys. They exclude the girls. They exclude any family member they think is vulnerable. They exclude the orphan that they're taking care of. That is why there is really no question that we have to do something about the 80% of poor countries that still charge fees, because there is no debate anymore that it makes a difference. When Tanzania eliminated fees and received help from the debt relief that you provided, their enrollment doubled from 1.5 to 3 million. When Uganda eliminated fees, they went from 3.5 million to 6.4 million. And when Kenya, when President Kibaki eliminated fees on his inaugural speech, By the next weekend, over 1 million new children showed up to school. And so that's why we brought the Minister of Education from Kenya here to talk about the challenges, because we wanted to be honest. When you have a lack of resources and you have that explosion, it puts pressure on quality. You get an explosion of class sizes, and you can have pressure downwards on quality. And I will say, Mr. President, you don't hear it in this room, but for those of us who work on this issue, what you often hear is that you just have to go slower. You just shouldn't try to get all the kids in school at once. And all I ever say about that is only something that people say about other people's children. There is nobody who would say that about their own children. There's no American here who would go home and tell their superintendent they have a great idea for quality. They'll just keep 40% of the kids out of school and devote the rest to their 60%. So in that panel, everybody shared the following goal: how to expand access and maintain quality. And so the answers that we saw were things like the Vicky Colbert's Escuela Nueva, that in a poor rural areas of Colombia, in multi-grade classrooms, you could divide kids up and have them doing the kind of self-paced, self-directed, analytical learning that a lot of people around this table pay $22,000 a year to have their children get in private schools. Vicky Colbert brought that to Colombia in the 1970s. That's the kind of quality people want. The kind of quality is what we saw from Andre Agassi, and when Lewis Katz stood up today at our last panel and said he would fund an Andre Agassi school in Camden, New Jersey. We also heard... a theme that was something that we dealt with all the time, Mr. President, which is how do you get teachers to the poorest areas? How do you give them the economic incentive? And how do you take away the stigma that somehow going to the poorest areas and dealing with the most vulnerable children is a stigma instead of a prestige? It was very fitting that Teach for America made the commitment to expand their model, because that goal came up in virtually every single panel. We also heard about how Kenya now gets the money to schools in local bank accounts, and they have parent supervisory committees who look at how every dollar is spent. If somebody wanted to do something corrupt, they would have to deal with the parents. I have never heard of a U.S. school community or PTA that is as vigilant as what we heard from in Kenya. And we also heard from the head of DFID in the U.K. the importance of long-term, predictable funding so that the Kenyas can have the time and planning to hire teachers. The recurrent, predictable funding to deal with the 80% of their cost of more teachers. Great Britain, through Gordon Brown, the Netherlands have led on this. We're very happy that in the United States right now there is a bipartisan piece of legislation. Republicans Gordon Smith and Spencer Baucus, joining with two New York Democrats, Nita Lowey, great champion on the Appropriations Committee for Education, who is here, and Hillary Clinton. And along with those four, you will soon discuss a new leader in the global education community, which is the leadership of the government of Dubai, who will discuss their enormous commitment, global commitment, into their region. Now, Mr. President, when we started, the one thing we wanted to make sure was that we didn't end up at the end of the day and say that we never had enough focus on the most disadvantaged of the most disadvantaged, that we didn't end and not have a discussion of the 20 million children who are expected to be orphaned from HIV/AIDS by 2010, or the millions of children who still work in abusive child labor, the children with disability, and the tens of millions of children in refugee areas internally displaced or post-conflict. So we didn't take any chances. We did two specific panels on them. And what we heard was compelling. In India, in a time that you sent me in India, I met a 9-year-old boy who rode the trains. He was marked up. I asked him how it was working the trains. He says, "It's okay on the way back." I said, "But why?" He said, "Well, on the way there, they beat me. But once I can shine a couple of shoes, I can bribe the security people so that I can make money on the way back." He was 9 years old. We heard from Indrajit Khurana. What she does is she takes the school to the train platforms. She's got a $200,000 budget. She serves 5,000 kids. She does whatever she has. And one of our CGI members came up and doubled her budget on the spot. We also heard in that same panel, Mr. President, Anderson Cooper. We also heard in that same panel, Mr. President, Anderson Cooper started by looking at Judy Heunen, who was your former advisor and World Bank advisor in education disability, and he said, "My briefing says that only 2% of children with disabilities in developing countries go to school. That can't be right." And Judy had to tell him that was right. That has got to be about the most disturbing statistic I have heard in years and years. And I just think we have to be honest. If we sit around and let that statistic remain, then let's just be transparent. We're just deciding that we think it's too hard. We're just deciding that those children don't count in the circle of children who we think of as our own children. Next year, Mr. President, starting tomorrow, we need more commitments on education for the most disabled children and the most underdeveloped economies in the world. But I'm proud that we were able to put a special focus on children in conflict, and we want to thank you. You took that panel on education and conflict, and you made it a plenary panel. I don't think the education of children of conflict has ever gotten the profile attention it got by you making that a plenary panel here at this CGI. And I was also very proud and lucky to have somebody like Angelina Jolie be willing to co-chair with myself a new partnership on education for children in conflict and see the kind of mega commitment, 18 groups, $148 million, 1 million lives affected. But it's hard to be proud of a glass half full when we still have a menu here of the glass half empty. And the projects that were not funded are children who have been displaced and been through the greatest horrors from Darfur. And that's why this has to be annual. We got to fill up that glass on children of conflict. We must get away from the notion that it is okay for the worst-off children to be satisfied or grateful for having the worst-off education. I cannot stand people who tell me, well, the children in the refugee camps actually are getting more education than children back in Darfur. That's true. 20% are getting a terrible education in Darfur, and 40 to 50% are getting a pretty mediocre education in refugee camps in Chad and elsewhere. How can that be good enough? Why would we have the perspective that the worst-off education is good enough for the worst-off children? I would like to tell the group to close your eyes and imagine that we reversed it, but you don't have to close your eyes. You saw Valentino Acheckdeng. At 9 years old, he was easily among the worst-off children on the planet. He was virtually naked. He was starving. He had left his home after his village had been massacred. He assumed his parents had been orphaned. He walked hundreds of miles to a refugee camp for a couple of years and then left with bullets flying at him as he walked another 800 miles to Kakuma. The child couldn't be much worse off, but there were some people in great organizations, like the people around here, who decided what would happen if he had the best education. And to see him up on stage at the Clinton Global Initiative in his suit speaking so eloquently, I mean, that is the face of the Clinton Global Initiative. Mr. President, I will close with the following thought. You and I are wonks. We marshal all the statistics we can. We make every case we can to prove things are right. But I do want to remind everybody that when Americans saw little girls in Afghanistan not going to school because of the Taliban, they didn't need to hear one single one of those statistics. They just thought it was wrong. They just thought it was an assault to human dignity. They just thought every child should have a chance to go to school. And what we have to remind people is that it is just as wrong when it's, instead of terrorists, extreme poverty, HIV/AIDS, child labor, child trafficking, or our lack of willingness to provide resources that keeps those same little girls and same little boys from going to school. Mr. President, every family has at least one story of that very determined grandparent or parent who, through an exceptional effort or an exceptional act of kindness or others, was able to get an education and then allowed their children to be educated. You, Mr. President, are that story. Valentino Achek Dang is that story. When you get one of those stories, you don't just help that child. You take what would be a cycle of despair and you make it a cycle of opportunity, going from one generation to the next, to the community, to the nation. Mr. President, those are the stories of CGI. Our goal in the education track is to spread those stories more and more. Thank you very much.
For those of you who may not know this, Gene Sperling's life has been tied to mine in one way or the other since 1991, when he became my principal economic advisor when I ran for president. And after I got elected, he and more than anyone else except for Bob Rubin was responsible for setting up the national economic infrastructure in the White House to mirror what we had previously only done for the National Security Council. And I am convinced that the changes we made, the ideas we had, and the heart he brought to the task played a major role in America's economic revival in the 1990s. And now that you heard him, you probably have no doubt why. Because of the commitments made here today, I just want to tell you what the combined impact. This is the first year we've done education as a separate commitment. Because of the commitments made here today, it will enable 8.5 million children around the world to go to school for the first time. Just the commitments coming here. That's about 7 times as many kids as are enrolled in New York City schools. It will enable us to train 1.5 million teachers around the world and give 19 million students access to nutrition or health care that they do not now have. That is an amazing record. But I want to point out a couple of other things. You heard Gene say there are 80 million kids, and Congresswoman Loy, thank you very much for being here and for sponsoring that wonderful legislation. Stand up, Nita. I want to recognize you there. Your partner's on the way, stuck in traffic. Let me just say, though, this issue offers a great opportunity and a warning. Because you already heard Gene say that we have to do 2 things here. We have to get all the kids in the world who aren't in school, but we can't just let them show up and have to scratch around on the ground without any learning materials and train teachers. And it shouldn't be an either-or choice. Now, this illustrates 2 points I want to make. One is, I have been criticized by some people for holding this, and for the book I wrote, Giving, by people who say, well, you know, Bill Clinton's implying that the private sector can handle all this and we don't really need any government, and that's a fraud. Well, I haven't ever said that. And I do think that some of these problems, particularly in education, clearly require public funds and government responses from national governments and from international organizations and from governments working together, which is why I was glad to hear Gene cite the legislation pending in the United States. It was the G8 that first committed to try to get all the kids in the world in school through primary school by 2015. we know there's a public response, and I'll say more about that in just a second. But this is also a problem that is ready-made for the kind of giving that goes on here. We heard John Chambers' eloquent statement last night in Carnegie Hall about what Cisco had tried to do to train teachers. There are some things that we're better suited to do in the private sector, number one. Number two, while we wait around for some public action that hasn't yet come, as Gene said, if it's your child, any parent in this audience knows that every single year in a child's life is a stunning panorama of often unpredictable development. And there's not a single parent here that would give up 1 year in your child's life waiting for somebody else to show up and do the right thing. Not one. And so the other point I wish to make is this is a ready-made thing for what we do here. And not just for the very wealthy. I could give you, if we had time today, I could give you example after example after example. Look what John Wood did. He quit Microsoft and went out and started raising money to build libraries, bring books, bring facilities to school. Look at Greg Mortensen, who wrote the wonderful book, Three Cups of Tea, established the Central Asia Institute, the toughest places in the world for a Westerner. Afghanistan and Pakistan in areas where people think all of us wear horns. But he was able to start schools and give learning equipment. Retired teachers in America, not rich people, who've been able to raise books and other learning materials and get the money to deliver them en masse to hundreds and hundreds of schools in Africa where people have no learning materials. There are so many examples of this. So this is something you don't have to be rich to have an impact on if you care enough about it. And something that together we can do. So I would say this education challenge means governments have to do more because there's more money there. And secondly, individuals have to do more because there's always going to be gaps and because very often we can do more in less time with less money. This is something we can do together. So I want to now acknowledge the next two commitments before we go on to the health track, or the energy track. First, I'd like to ask my good friend Sheikh Mohammed Al-Gagawi, the Minister of State for Cabinet Affairs of the United Arab Emirates, to come up here. There he is. This is a commitment from Dubai, probably the fastest growing place on earth. You know, the famous American humorist Will Rogers only gave one piece of economic advice to the American people when he was alive and well. He said, buy land, they ain't making no more of it. It turns out that's not true. Dubai's the only place in the world which has proved Will Rogers wrong after all these decades. When they run out of land, they just make more of it. They have made an island nation around their land nation. But they have made a significant commitment to a community-based fundraising campaign to support primary education for children in developing nations. It will be held during the holy month of Ramadan, which helps improve the learning environment for over 1 million children in developing countries. That's what they're going to do. Earlier this month, His Highness Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum, the Vice President and Prime Minister of the UAE and the ruler of Dubai, launched the campaign. The Dubai royal family started this, but the campaign is a community effort which sets out to offer new school facilities in developing countries, to renovate existing schools, to provide scholarships to students, to provide food programs and annual medical checkups. Now, you've already heard what Gene said. 80 million kids not in school under 12. Through the high school years, there's 134 million kids who aren't in school. There are 28 countries, developing countries, that each have at least 500,000 kids out of school. And about 53% of the people not in primary schools are girls, and in many countries that figure is way over 60%. So we thank you, Mohammed. We thank His Highness. We thank the people of Dubai. And we ask others to follow suit. Thank you for Dubai Cares. Now, I'd like to ask Stephen Chen, the co-founder of YouTube, and Chad Hurley to come forward. This project involves YouTube and Google, right? Larry Page is here. You want to come up? Come on up. I want you up here because I want people to see the person responsible for the Internet taking over their lives. Thank you. This is a commitment to a YouTube nonprofit program to enable organizations to broadcast their cause to a global audience. It's an in-kind donation worth about $20 million. YouTube is the world's largest online video community. They've been very good to us here at CGI. I will explain that later. They're creating a special section dedicated to nonprofits to provide an opportunity for nonprofits to increase branding and presence online, including a new fundraising feature, again, to empower small donors. Visitors to YouTube's homepage will also be directed to the nonprofit channels. And I encourage all of you can go to youtube.com/nonprofits and explore it for yourself. By the end of 2008, listen to this, they hope to reach 1 billion playbacks. YouTube has over 30 million visitors a day. Over 100 million videos are viewed each day. And while some larger charities get already 10 to 15% of their donations online, smaller foundations have had trouble establishing an online presence. I said earlier, in the education area, America alone has an enormous number of smaller foundations devoted to education. I wrote about some of them in my book, but that'll be a drop in the bucket compared to what YouTube will be able to do for them. And all of a sudden, all these smaller efforts, which will document on YouTube the results they're getting, so that people who have money can actually see, well, if I put money into this, I will have a absolute certainty that I'll get this return. This is an enormous, enormous service. These little foundations doing big work could never have reached people without this gift, and we thank them very much for this. Thank you. Now I would like to call on David Sandalo to give us his report on energy and climate change.
You did it again, Mr. President. For 3 days, our climate sessions have been jam-packed, not just with bodies, but with energy, enthusiasm, and ideas. You've brought together a remarkable group of people to learn, to connect, and to take action. What happens in this room will not stay in this room, Mr. President. This is not Las Vegas. What happens in this room will have an impact around the world for years to come. Our climate sessions would not have been possible without the extraordinary work of three deputies, Michael Terrell, PJ Simmons, and Amy Christensen. I hope you'll all give them a big round of applause. Our climate sessions opened with a focus on follow-through. As you said in the opening plenary, CGI is about promises made and promises kept. During the past year, many people have asked me, so what exactly is Sir Richard Branson doing to follow through on his $3 billion commitment? So we started our climate sessions by letting one of Sir Richard's top executives, Shai Weiss, answer that question. The list of activities he reported was impressive, from solar investments to trains running on biodiesel to a new technology prize. We heard from other members about what they have done to follow up on their commitments as well. If a single word could capture the climate portion of the meeting, Mr. President, it would be momentum. Public awareness of the climate crisis is growing. The private sector is beginning to respond, and so are some governments. And CGI members are making bigger, more innovative, and more important commitments than ever before. At our opening lunch, Brad Pitt and Steve Bing, who's right here, announced a $10 million matching grant for the sustainable rebuilding of New Orleans. Later, Wallace Global Fund committed $100,000 to support an extraordinary pledge by President Correa of Ecuador not to drill in the Yusani rainforest. President Correa got a standing ovation when he appeared in our room. Skidmore, Owings & Merrill and Patrick Gatriti announced a program to build energy-positive buildings. That is, buildings that produce more energy than they consume. And this program grew directly from conversations that Patrick had with you at the CGI mid-year meeting, Mr. President. The Joint U.S. Committee on Climate Change and Clean Energy committed to distribute for free 10 million compact fluorescent light bulbs in China. And yesterday we had a CGI first, a $3 billion commitment announced at a working session. Pacific Gas and Electric commits to buy 1,000 megawatts of solar power over the next 5 years, and the solar thermal company Ausra commits to provide it. Mr. President, the commitment by utility executives that you recognized yesterday could transform energy efficiency in this country. The commitment grew out of conversations between you and Jim Rogers at the White Oak Plantation at a CGI meeting earlier this year. Since then, this commitment has grown and grown, and I believe it could change the world. And a word about one final commitment. Last year, Standard Chartered Bank came to this conference and made an inspiring commitment on microfinance. Its CEO left CGI last year and told his staff, "That was good. Next year, let's do something great." He charged his staff with thinking about big ideas and how the bank could help solve one of the problems discussed here. And yesterday, Standard Chartered Bank announced a $4 to $5 billion fund for promoting renewable energy in the developing world. Mr. President, we can't measure anything in life, including a commitment, in money alone. But a $4 to $5 billion commitment inspired by this conference is still a very good thing. The dialogue in the climate rooms was dazzling. We took up the issue of forests and climate change for the first time at CGI. Sue Eisenstadt emphasized how little is known about this topic on Capitol Hill. Jane Goodall spoke eloquently, referring to the melting ice in the Arctic and asking, "What will it take to melt the ice in the human heart?" We focused quite specifically on green buildings at a session just this morning, with Bill McDonough and panelists from around the world telling us how green buildings can save money and improve lives. Ted Turner told us that climate change is the big story of our lives, and he's someone who should know about stories. Dr. Sultan Ahmed Al-Jaber told us about the Masdar Initiative, his path-breaking alternative energy program in Abu Dhabi. Craig Venter described visionary ideas for using genomics to help solve the climate crisis. And Jim Rogers told us that to fight global warming, we need cathedral thinking. Building a cathedral, he said, often took sustained commitment over many generations. Building a clean energy economy will do the same. An extraordinary part of our climate sessions this year was that many of the most powerful and eloquent ideas came from the table discussions in our rooms. The single theme that emerged most was the need to put a price on carbon, kept on coming up again and again. The benefits of energy efficiency were also a constant theme, and our members suggested dozens of specific commitment ideas that they'll be pursuing in the year ahead. People suggested that every CGI member should commit to purchase only certified and sustainably produced wood. Every CGI member should commit to do an energy audit of his or her home and then reduce emissions. Someone suggested forming a partnership to help Haiti become a totally green energy nation, something that some people here are already working on. Somebody suggested sending Fortune 500 CEOs to the Arctic. I think they were talking about a round-trip ticket, but that wasn't entirely clear.
This year, it keeps melting. It doesn't matter. They'll just float back.
This year's conference was filled with stories of members coming together to solve problems, and For example, we recently determined that the offsetting the carbon footprint of all of the Clinton Global Initiative's operations for 2007 would require about $100,000 more in offsets than those already generously provided by Swiss Re. So when we mentioned this 2 days ago to two of our members, Kurt Moffitt and Jack Hittery, and they decided to take it upon themselves to raise the amount that we needed. And over just the last 48 hours, Mr. President, they have identified, I think it's 14, it keeps going up, every time I leave the number goes up, but I think 14 donors, each of whom pledges $10,000 to make sure that the Clinton Global Initiative is completely carbon neutral. And so with your permission, Mr. President, I'd like to ask Kurt and Jack to join you on the stage and also any of the other donors who are here in the room, Barry Appleton, Mike Northrup and Jessica Bailey from the Rockefeller Brothers Foundation, please come to the stage. Roger Barnett, Rolando Gonzalez-Bunster, Zachary Carabel, Susan Tomaski from AEP, Julia Novi-Hiltesley from the Lemelson Foundation, Mark Mathieu and Jeff Seabright from Coca-Cola, Sunil Paul, Martin Varsevsky, Jim Rogers, Brian Schneider, Herman Bulbecker, and Bruce Usher of EcoSecurities. We'd also like to thank the law firm Van Ness Feldman for providing legal work to support this. Now, the funds that these individuals are contributing are going to be invested in clean energy projects of other CGI members, such as Harish Handi's solar programs in India and Wangari Maathai's tree planting around the world.
Give him a hand, huh?
During the climate sessions, many of our members noted the incandescent light bulbs in the ceilings above us. So, Mr. President, in the spirit of CGI, your climate deputies and I are making a commitment. During the next year, Michael Terrell, P.J. Simmons, Amy Christensen, and I will work with the management at this hotel to see if we can persuade them to make the money-saving switch to compact fluorescent bulbs. If CGI returns to this site next year, we hope to have compact fluorescent bulbs shining down on all of us at that time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let me first of all say what all this means. The CGI commitments, just to put this report in context, I thought we'd done pretty well on this front last year, just because of Richard Branson's commitment, if no other. But these collective commitments will restore or protect more than 170 million acres of forest, an area larger than the combined area of Germany, Italy, and Switzerland. They will prevent the introduction into the atmosphere of 567 million tons of greenhouse gases, about the annual CO2 output of Canada. Amazing. So I thank you all. Now, again, I want to say this is one of those areas where all the private action in the world is not enough, but government can't solve the problem alone. Government is necessary, among other things, to provide frameworks and jump starts. As the President DuPont said so eloquently yesterday in our BBC discussion. And I want to thank you again, Anita, and I wish Hillary here, because they also have legislation in the Congress to train many, many green collar workers. I think it's for several million dollars. And another, it's great. That's the reason American incomes are flat, by the way, because we don't have more green-collar workers, so we're going to train them. And another bill to provide immediate funding support to retrofit all the public buildings in America as quickly as possible. So I think this is very important. Thank you very much. So it's not an either-or thing. But I just want to point out, there is still, amazingly enough, a debate in the world about whether this is good or bad economics. On the ground, people know better. We have the president of Malawi here is actually publicly invested with a private company to produce biofuels from Jatropha, which they will then export to Europe. The very eloquent prime minister of Ethiopia told you what his plans were for biofuel production in Africa. I have long argued that with oil prices at their current level, the Middle East should transform itself from the oil center of the world to the energy center of the world. And if you've been keeping up, at least in the UAE and some of the other Gulf countries, they're seriously considering doing that. But I think their future is enormous. I mean, the word emir is the root word of the English word admiral. The Middle East, long before oil was discovered, was a great seafaring area, and the wind blows there, and the sun sure shines. So their options are enormous. There were a couple of things that may escape notice here that I want to emphasize that show how much progress we are making. One is the two solar commitments, $1.3 billion in the small meeting, and the $2.5 billion commitment made by the Florida utility. Big problem with solar is you've got to figure out a way to distribute it over time, because right now the per kilowatt cost is about three times or more higher than the best wind and long-term coal contracts. And that's for basically the silicon reflectors, which are at best about 18% efficient. And a lot of interesting things have been going on, like the Japanese are trying to put them up at angles so you get heat bouncing off the concrete underneath them and increasing the efficiency a little bit. But it's still a real struggle. Now, passive solar is much less expensive, but and it's used in homes primarily for the hot water heater. Basically, a lot of people keep their swimming pools heated by passive solar. It'll heat water, but that's never been able to be used on a larger scale. What these people are trying to do, and what they believe they can do, is use more passive solar technology to heat so much water to such a high temperature that it will actually turn enough turbines to, in the Florida case, to electrify over 40,000 homes. If they can do this, it offers a huge, ironically, almost lower tech solution to the solar dilemma. Enough sunlight falls on the earth every day, even at current levels of efficiency, to electrify the whole world for a year, every day. But we're no good at figuring out how to convert it and distribute it at affordable prices. So what these two experiments are trying to do, if they pull it off, it could change the whole landscape of and the old economics of solar power, not just in the United States, but in Germany, which is now the biggest user of solar technology and not exactly a hot place or always sunny, which would change things for all of Europe, and in several other places as well. So I thank you for that. It also, I hope, helps to answer this argument, which is continuing to be put out in books, which is that it's just not worth lowering the economic growth of the world to do this, because, after all, the planet may not burn up this century, and there are more pressing arguments. There's actually a book that's been written by one of the climate skeptics attacking our efforts from the left, saying, oh, we shouldn't be spending all this money. We should be spending it on poverty and education, all that, ignoring the fact that anybody who does this right is going to create more jobs, enlarge their tax base, diversify and democratize their economy, and therefore generate more funds for education, for health care, for fighting disease, for doing all this. This is a crazy thing. So, I thank all of you for your involvement here. Now, we have two more commitments which illustrate the diversity of what is being done in this area. First of all, I would like to ask President Ólafur Grímsson of the Republic of Iceland and Guðmundur Thoroddsen, the CEO of Reykjavik Energy Invest, to come up here. As any of you have been to Iceland know, Iceland, as you travel around, looks like the place on earth God intended to be the geothermal center of the universe. But Iceland is not the only place where geothermal power is widely in use. And as we were at the opening ceremony, you know that the Philippines is now generating about a quarter of their electricity already from geothermal power, something which has kept their costs down and increased their sense of energy security. This commitment is to advance the development of geothermal energy in East African countries. It's worth $150 million over 5 years. Reykjavik Energy Invest is committing to use its expertise and networks to advance the development of geothermal energy, initially focusing on Djibouti and Ethiopia. And they're looking for partners to help African nations move further toward new energy sources that are beneficial to all. Djibouti and Ethiopia are among 10 African nations that have agreed to increase geothermal power generation to reach a total of 1,000 megawatts by 2010. They have the potential themselves of producing 7,000 megawatts annually. Ethiopia's geothermal potential has been placed at 1,000 megawatts, just that country alone. But today, only 8.5 megawatts have been harnessed at a given time. So what they can do, particularly in the countries of the African Rift Valley, to advance a clean energy future, create more growth, not less, and democratize economic opportunity is enormous. Mr. President, you have been passionate about this for a long time. Iceland is a fascinating country. It has a disproportionate, grossly disproportionate number of Europe's most successful entrepreneurs. And now it is going to have a grossly disproportionate impact in social entrepreneurism, helping people in Africa. And we are very grateful to you.
The next
commitment is an important one for the United States. I'd like to ask Mayor Cory Booker from Newark, Lucy Blake, the CEO of Apollo Alliance, Bai Adolfo Wilson, the Executive Director of the Lincoln Park Coast Cultural District, Bracken Hendricks, Senior Fellow for the Center for the American Progress, and Majora Carter, the Executive Director of Sustainable South Bronx, to come forward. All these people, plus Wendy New, Green for All, Green Order, and Christensen Global Strategies, have made a commitment to organize the Newark Green Future Summit to support Newark's commitment to a clean, efficient, prosperous future at a value of $350,000. The Newark Green Future Summit will bring together the nation's leading experts on green energy and sustainability to create a roadmap for sustainable development. The partners are launching here today an effort to create a network that will provide ongoing support to the city for the summit and beyond, to provide advice and help the city and the mayor to develop initiatives that will also create jobs and expand opportunity. Today, the unemployment rate in Newark is about 10%. The ratio of park space to people is one of the lowest in the nation, at fewer than 3 acres of parkland per 1,000 residents, versus most major cities, which average about 7 acres per 1,000. Mayor Booker is one of the mayors who have signed the mayor's climate change protection agreement. Mayor Bloomberg said the number was 360. I actually think it's closer to 400 now. He has promised that Newark will meet or beat the Kyoto Protocol targets by achieving at least a 7% reduction in the 1990 greenhouse gas emission levels by 2012. And I expect him to do it. And I predict to you it will be the most effective part of his economic development strategy. So when Cory Booker was elected mayor, he came up to see me. We talked about all the things he could do and had a vigorous agreement that inner city areas with high levels of unemployment had missed a golden opportunity in seizing this. If you just retrofit all the buildings, you will create ungodly number of jobs for people who have relatively low levels of education, but high levels of skills and are quite trainable. So I congratulate you, Mayor, and all of your partners. This is going to be a very great thing. And as you do it, you'll have other cities mobbing your doorstep trying to figure out how to follow suit. Thank you very much. Now I would like to move to the health section and introduce Tom Khalil.
Thank you, Mr. President. From the bottom of my heart, I want to thank you for the opportunity to be a member of the CGI team and for the privilege of serving in your administration. And I also want to thank my hardworking CGI colleagues, Hillary Freudenthal, Ellen Levy, Heather Kinlaw, Stephanie Weber. I knew Hillary was a true CGI staffer when she dialed into a CGI conference call while picking out her wedding dress. So she had the Clinton work ethic. Mr. President, if we believe that every life has equal value, then we must view the huge inequities that exist in global health as unconscionable. It's wrong that nearly 10 million children under the age of 5 die every year from primarily easily treatable or preventable diseases. It's wrong that 500,000 women die during childbirth or from pregnancy-related complications. Giving birth to a child should be a blessing, not a deadly game of Russian roulette. And it's wrong that 2 billion people suffer from micronutrient deficiency, even though this is something that could be addressed for less than a quarter per person per year. Mr. President, as we say in California, if you don't like the news, go out and make some of your own. And during the past 3 days, a far-sighted group of leaders in government, business, and civil society has been doing just that. With your permission, I'd like to provide a detailed description of all 58 commitments in global health.
He's only half joking.
Yeah. Consider the extraordinary generosity of Norway and the Netherlands, who pledged $1.2 billion to save the lives of millions of women and children. If the United States were to make a comparable pledge to what Prime Minister Stoltenberg did, a leader of a country of 4.7 million, that would be $60 billion over 10 years. Dow Chemical and Water Health International are joining forces to provide safe drinking water to 11 million people in India using a simple system based on UV light, which kills deadly pathogens. Helen Keller International is partnering with West African food producers to alleviate vitamin A deficiency for 60 million people in 8 African countries. Doris Duke Charitable Foundation is investing $100 million to strengthen African health systems. And in addition to following through on last year's commitment to make the rotavirus vaccine available to the children of Nicaragua, Merck agreed to provide enough vaccines to safeguard 1 million women from cervical cancer, a particular problem in developing countries where screening is not available. This is a commitment worth $375 million. In addition to these and many equally memorable initiatives, the working group session also grappled with some of the most important challenges in global health, including maternal and child health, vaccines, drug resistance in AIDS, TB, and malaria, and global nutrition. The panelists and CGI members provided powerful and compelling ideas for providing health for all. Imagine that the G8 and developing countries themselves embrace the issue of maternal and child health with the same level of passion and intelligence of Norway and the Netherlands, inspired by the Deliver Now for Women and Children campaign. Think of how many lives would be saved if more food and beverage companies joined the Global Alliance for Improved Nutrition and agreed to add vitamins and minerals to their products. What if pharma and biotech companies could make more money developing a vaccine for AIDS, TB, and malaria than they could for addressing the market for impotence and baldness? What if students all over the world could win scholarships for developing new health applications for use on the 3 billion cell phones that exist today, providing information to community health workers and midwives in remote villages. What if the best minds of Madison Avenue embraced global health as their cause? Let me give you just one example of why this is so important. Every year, 2 million children die from pneumonia. Yet policymakers and the public don't know this because the experts call it acute lower respiratory infection. That's because the experts don't know the importance of occasionally being clearer than the truth. What's so exciting about CGI is that the people in the room and the broader community of individuals and organizations that we're interacting with has the ability to make these ideas happen. By convening heads of state, business leaders, philanthropists, and social entrepreneurs, we can create the change we wish to see in the world. Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, now that you've heard from Gene and David and Tom, you know that I have no shortage of zealots among my friends. All that little crack about baldness and the other deal, I thought that's spoken by a young man with a full head of hair. I think you're great. I thank you for that. I want to say a few words about this, but I also would like to say I'm glad the New York traffic let up and you finally got here, Hillary, and the two most important people in my life are there together. Thank you both for being here. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Now, this is another one of those areas where it's not an either-or between government and the private sector. And you, if you listen carefully to Tom's recitation of commitments, you know that. But I thought it was important when you extrapolated if we gave as much as Norway. Interestingly enough, we don't have to give as much as Norway. If we just gave our percentage income based on the OECD, the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, the world's wealthy countries, if we gave over and above what we now spend, our percentage of that, about 35-36%, to meeting not just health, but all the Millennium Development Goals, it would only be $40 billion more a year, or approximately 4 months of our combined special budgets for the conflicts in which we're engaged. So it's something, and again, I'm not, whether you're for or against those things, the point I'm trying to make is, in the modern world, the single most expensive thing a wealthy country can do is go to war. What do you think? And I believe in a strong national defense, and I believe sometimes you have to trigger it, but you can't be naive here. It is the single most expensive thing you can do. Whether you're for or against policy X, Y, or Z, there's no question that a more cost-effective approach is to allocate some of your resources to making a world with more partners and fewer adversaries and giving all the children of the world a chance to live up to their God-given potential. So I thank you for giving us the number, Tom. Now, let me say, let me just say something about the commitments that have been made in larger context. Do the following. They give 50 million people around the world targeted treatment for neglected tropical diseases. 50 million. Just the commitments made here. That's more people than the combined populations of Florida, Texas, and Virginia in the U.S., for example. It provides 400 million gallons of clean water to people in the developing world at a time when there are 1 billion people who have no access to clean water, and that is one of the principal reasons that so many children under 5 die every year needlessly. It raises $1.25 billion to support maternal and child health and survival programs. That's one of the Millennium Development Goals. And it will give emergency and primary care for 39 million people in the developing world. This is an amazing record from all of you, and I thank you very, very much. Um, Now we have two final commitments in the health area. The first one involves Kleiner Perkins, Caulfield and Byers and PATH. And I'd like to ask whoever's here from there. I think Brooks Byers is here. Brooke Byers is here, the senior partner of Kleiner Perkins. And I believe Chris Elias, the president of PATH, are here. And if they are, I'd like to ask them to come up. And if they've not, I've got bad news. Hi, bro. Thanks. Hi, Chris. Thank you. Let me read their commitment. Last year, Kleiner Perkins and Mr. Byers committed $45 million to create four new ventures to innovate in infectious diseases and pandemic preparedness. They follow through on this commitment, studying over 200 projects and choosing six to support, including a vaccine manufacturing system that costs one-tenth of the conventional method to set up and operate, better antivirals for avian flu, and low-cost point-of-care diagnosis for avian flu. This is why I'm saying it shouldn't be an either-or deal. This is the kind of thing that you expect the non-governmental sector to be able to do more quickly and more creatively. Next month, Brooke will convene a meeting of 250 biotech CEOs and work to persuade other leaders in the industry to tackle these kinds of challenges in global health. Upon hearing about this commitment, they decided to work together, these two people, to promote global access to breakthroughs in both developed and developing countries. They are committed to invest $135 million in things that will save lives. Let's give them a hand. That's great. Now I would like to ask Milan Verveer, the co-founder and chair of Vital Voices Global Partnership, and Elena Franchuk, the founder of the Elena Franchuk Anti-AIDS Foundation in Ukraine, to come up here, please.
Thank you. Hi, Elena. Thank you.
This commitment is to host the Eurasian Summit as part of Vital Voices Global Leadership Initiative for Women and Girls. This involves training programs and grants to develop women's leadership programs in places where they do not much exist now. The Elena Franchuk Anti-AIDS Foundation will sponsor the Eurasia Summit to take place in Ukraine to serve as a model for others around the world to impact the lives of thousands of emerging women leaders. In addition to Elena's commitment, the World Bank, Ken and Jill Iskell, and others have partnered to support this initiative and implement specific action plans all around the world. It builds on the success of the effort Vital Voices made in their Pan-Africa Leadership Summit held this last January. In a study of 61 nations between 1980 and 1990, the researchers found a positive correlation between economic growth and women's participation in the labor force. In Africa, women account for more than 60% of the rural labor force and contribute 80% of total food production, but receive less than 10% of the credit made available to farmers. So this is an example of what needs to be done economically and in the health area. We cannot possibly roll back the tide on HIV and AIDS, which is, interestingly enough, becoming quite a challenge in Ukraine and many other countries in the former Soviet Union. So I am grateful to both of them, and I look forward to the results of their summit. Thank you very much. Now, to hear from our last participant, who many believe people is my non-identical twin, but she's much younger than I am.
Thank you.
We are basically thought of as the two most pale-skinned, white-haired people to believe they really came out of Africa. Gail Smith, make your report on poverty.
The good thing is they do say about white hair is that it means we're wise. We spent a lot of the last 3 days with people who are very wise. And I want to start by quoting one of them who said, "We are not poor, we are creative." Those are the words of Albina Ruiz, a woman from Peru who saw an opportunity in garbage. A woman who organized her fellow citizens, the scavengers of waste dumps, to take on recycling, create new jobs, and formalize and dignify an informal and invisible form of labor. Mr. President, our discussions throughout the poverty track this year were about creativity. Our focus was on how we can creatively tap into the fundamental levers of change with an eye to not just reducing poverty, but also to generating wealth, peace, and justice. This year, we identified five areas, five levers of change that, with our sustained commitment and focus, can go beyond compensating for poverty and towards transforming the lives of the poor. Our job is not to make up for poverty, but to build a world where we create less of it. And here's how we talked about doing it. The first, as someone said at the outset, the way to spell poverty reduction is J-O-B-S. We talked about jobs, and we heard someone say that when people have jobs, they can say citizen. We heard someone explain that in a recent survey in Afghanistan, a Talib was described as a young man without a job. We focused on training, the need for training that matches the needs of the future and not just the fad of the moment, on building community companies and providing incentives for moving people from the informal to the formal sector. We talked about public-private partnerships, and we're reminded that it's about more than just joining up to build a single school. It's aligning our forces and our vision to provide 10,000 schools. And we discussed the need to build the public part. We need the private sector, we need NGOs, but we also need governments that work and work for their people. We focused on the opportunities that can emerge from the chaos of war and crisis. We focused on how to break the bottlenecks that constrain development and on how to build out the economic sectors that can drive a new economy while rebuilding a shattered one. And we talked about women. This was not, Mr. President, your grandmother's panel on women. This was not about checking the box. This was about constructing an entirely new box. This was about how, in our minds and in our practice, we can act on one simple fact. If we want to change the world, change regions, transform countries, rebuild societies, or invest in communities, women are not an add-on. They are the way in and the way forward. And we looked at how to get more resources to the table to enable those tens of thousands of entrepreneurs who are out there to build their local economies and join the global economy. We confronted head-on the need for all of us to take on more risk, to understand that it takes time for smart businesses to grow and longer for them to flourish, and to provide the full range of financial tools and means to use them if we want entrepreneurship to be more than the exception to the rule. Now, we had spectacular commitments, and I encourage all of you to read about those and learn about them because they will inspire you to do more. But we don't usually tell people till the end that the commitment you made this year covers you for the 365 days leading up to today. Now we're going to talk about the future. And what I'd like to share with you that was unique about the poverty track this year is that between our panelists and our members, when we asked people to focus on solutions, we got terrific ideas. So I'm just going to quickly give you the top 10 with the challenge that the people in this room think about how between today and next year we can get as many of these done as possible. Number one, build the construction sector in countries that are torn by war. It apparently takes 6 months. You build jobs, you build local industries. 6 months to turn an economy around. It hasn't been done once in 40 years. Two, Set up Training Without Borders modules. Any company can do this. Any NGO can do this. Craft a team of people who can train in financial management and other skills that can be applied across sectors. For our financial institutions, I think we may have a few of them here. Streamline access to investment capital. Put together a package of investment tools like the Palestinian Risk Insurance for countries coming out of war. Risk insurance, low-impact loans, guarantees. Let's set up labs for small and medium enterprises. Combine venture capitalists, educators, entrepreneurs, representatives of communities on the ground, and try and see what works, even in the most challenging places. Let's get governments, NGOs, the informal and the formal sector in the same room and figure out what regulation looks like for the poorest of the poor. Let's set up a capital equipment donation program where large companies can foster small industries around the world by donating that equipment that they have and are no longer using. Let's set up a global directory of partners for public-private partnerships, a clearinghouse of ideas, international standards, success stories, and best practices. Let's every company and NGO here sign on to a set of policies to underscore the importance of balancing work and life, to support flex time, job sharing, and measurable goals for ensuring that women are engaged in governance as well as work. You've heard of the brain drain. Let's set up a brain gain. Let's set up something so that expatriate women from around the world who may have come to the U.S. or Europe for an education can go home and give back to their home countries. Finally, and I will look at Mary Robinson as I say this, who is part of perhaps one of the most important new initiatives of recent time, the creation of the elders. Let's set up a group of women elders to lead us, to teach us what we've forgotten, and to point the way forward. Finally, Mr. President, Jeffrey Wright made a comment about the need for us to reimagine reality. So I'd like to leave you with this, which I hope can represent the views of all of you who attended the poverty track. The reality we must reimagine is one where more of us are making and pursuing ideas than are against them, where more of us are working together, despite and regardless of our views, than are tearing ourselves apart, and that there are more of us that are fighting poverty than are condemned to live in it. Thank you.
Let me say that the commitments made in the poverty track combined will empower 11,200,000 people who could otherwise not do so to earn sustainable living. So thank you very much, everybody who made a commitment in this area. And in terms of the suggestions, let me just say, I personally have just seen evidence of the value of the first suggestion, to build a construction sector, because through our partnership with Sir Tom Hunter, we have a health care and a development effort going on in Rwanda. Thank you, President Kagame, for being here, for giving us a chance to work. And Malawi. Thank you. And so I went to Malawi, way out in the country, to a place where they never had a hospital before. Because under the Partners in Health model, you need one hospital, then satellite clinics, then you train a zillion people to be paramedics so they can figure out who needs to keep coming toward the health care. So we built the hospital, and then we had to build housing for the people who would work in the hospital. First of all, I think a lot of you have no idea how much good you can do for how little money. We built a 100-bed hospital for $550,000. You couldn't build a room in New York City for $500,000. And then we built a row of nice houses for the people that worked there. There were 500 people working in construction who had never worked before. About half of them were women. Not a single one of them ever in their lives had gotten a regular paycheck before this. So I'm going down examining the hospital construction, because I'm interested in how things are built. And I ask a question of the construction manager, and He said, that's good. I'm glad you understand that. He said, you know, I met you once before. I said, where? He said, you were jogging in Seattle in 1992. And I said, well, what were you doing there? He said, working for Boeing. I said, are you from Malawi? He said, yep. I said, how long did you work for Boeing? He said, 12 years. I said, what are you doing here? He said, my country needed me more than Boeing did. And I say that people will go home and reverse the brain drain if they believe there is opportunity, if they believe their lives can be productive, if they think they can have an impact. So I thank you very much. We have a couple of commitments now in this area I want to announce, and then we'll move to the closing. First of all, I want to invite to the stage William Bissell, the Managing Director of Fab India. Fab India and the Wolfenson Family Foundation. If anybody's here from the Wolfenson family, they're welcome to come up too. Hello. Their commitment is to encourage and support community-owned artisanal businesses through expertise, knowledge, and network sharing. They commit to support community-owned Indian businesses by organizing groups of artisans and marginalized crafts workers into shareholders of local companies and use their access to product markets to create a link for artisans to sell their products. Over the next 3 to 5 years, they will support 100 microfinance institutions, 100 small and medium-sized enterprises, 100,000 shareholders from groups of artisans, and impact 500,000 lives. By keeping entry barriers to new shareholders low, Fab India will bring innovative reforms to an economic system in need of accommodating an expanding community of entrepreneurs. India has over 123 million artisans. Most of them have to sell their products through middlemen. They often earn less than 5% of the end price of their goods. I learned this when the earthquake hit Gujarat, and the previous Prime Minister, Mr. Vajpayee, asked me to come work there. And we set up the America India Foundation and started trying to do this. I saw it again when the tsunami hit the other part of the country. And the Indians, in my opinion, did the best job of all the affected countries, diversifying the economy and moving people into crafts. But they also realized they had to bypass the traditional network in order to get any real cash into the hands of the artisans. There was an upheaval in India in the last election because it was the first time, as far as I know, in the history of any democratic political system when a government that had regularly produced 9% growth a year was replaced by the opposition. It happened in the country with the biggest middle class in the world because the non-middle class was twice as big as the middle class and believed that there was no system in place which would expand the opportunities being embraced by the third that had it to the two-thirds that didn't. This is what he's going to do. This is a very big deal. In every developing country in the world where they're enjoying success, there is enormous tension between the new economy and the old, between those who are doing better and those who feel left behind. This will help close that gap, and we applaud it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, I don't know how many people on this next commitment are here, but I know Jack Timer is. I saw him in the audience of HPJ Media Management. We also have the Goodnight Foundation, Passport Resorts, and Small Luxury Hotels of the World are all involved in this commitment. So, Jack, come up here. And if anybody else is here, we welcome you to come up. Hey, buddy. This is a very interesting idea. They have committed, all of these people, to collect donations from hotel guests in an effort to provide financial support to global organizations and initiatives that focus on these tracks: poverty, education, health, and the environment. And their commitment is to get $3 million in the very first year. The Good Night Foundation will collect $3 per night from guests who stay at small luxury hotels, but they will give, obviously, the guests the opportunity to opt out. They're betting most of them will opt in. So am I. This is, by the way, something that we ought to think about all over the world. We're going to have 100,000 kids getting AIDS medicine, pediatric AIDS medicine this year, through our foundation because of Unitaid, with a French system to impose an airline tax. And then 19 other countries have kicked in some money. And it's very popular in France because they know all the money is going to help fight disease in the poorest countries of the world. We were at 10,000 people 2 years ago. Private donors gave us enough money to go to 20, with 500,000 kids a year dying. In 1 year, we went to 100,000 because of this kind of system. And if you think about a place in the world where you can make it easy for all the upper income people of the world who rent a place and they're spending money anyway, they have loose change to do. This is a great idea. They will include, as I said, all the recipients involved in the major areas that our global initiative deals with. And they will begin by looking at specifically oceanic research in the environment, economic enhancement programs, and access to quality health and basic health care for children in Uganda in the beginning. In the U.S., in 2006, corporations and corporate foundations donated an estimated $12.7 billion. Believe it or not, that was less than they donated in 2005. About 2 million children in Uganda under 6 live in poverty. 2 million die before their first birthday. Under our agreements, it currently costs only $60, for example, to treat a child with HIV and AIDS. So they want to help address that. They also want to help address the healthcare problems in other places in the world where many of us are involved. I think this is a great idea, and I wouldn't be surprised if they didn't beat their $3 million goal. Let's give them a big hand. I might add in a slightly sneaky way that I am well aware that there are people in this audience who are the owners of hotels not in the groups I just mentioned, where the majority of the people who spend the night in them have even more money than the people who are spending night in these hotels. So if you want to participate, none of us will object. Now, I need to say a few thank yous, if I might, and talk about where we go from here. First of all, I want to thank again the working group chairs and all the members of the working groups. They have been dedicated, and I think you could see they've really done amazing work. And every one of them has something else to do, so for several months a year they have two full-time jobs, much to the dismay of their families, but we're very grateful. I also want to thank John Needham and all the staff of CGI and Laura Graham and Bruce Lindsay, especially Tasha Alvarez and Ami Desai, who worked so hard on my staff. And we ought to give Scott Givens a big hand, who kept us all coming on the stage at the right time. There were 450 people who volunteered their time to help to put this meeting on. So let's give them all a big hand. I want to recognize one of you all got a little gift bag, and in that gift bag, there was a DVD of the activities and a progress report in very human terms of CGI. That DVD was itself the product of a CGI commitment by a wonderful group called Students of the World, headed by a young woman I've known since she was born, named Courtney Spence. They did a great job. I want you to watch that DVD and you will see CGI come alive in ways that our words cannot. But I thank the Students of the World because it's a proof again that young people can make a contribution to this and you don't have to have a lot of money to do it. There are more than 1,200 attendees here. You have already made 245 commitments since Wednesday. The collective impact of these commitments will impact well over 100 million people. That's really, I think, pretty good. And I'm very grateful to you. I also want to say, we have had an amazing impact over the internet, and I'll say something about that in a minute. But before I do, I would like to thank the members of the media who are here. They've really covered this thing exhaustively. Last 2006, we had 350 credentialed members of the media. This year, 950 people showed up credentialed. It's a great tribute for their interest, and we thank them. Now, on Wednesday, at the beginning of our proceedings, I told you that we had set up a special website, mycommitment.org, through CGI to involve all kinds of new people who can't be with us in New York, but who want to engage in giving and service. In the last 2 days, more than 20,000 people, from as close as New York City's boroughs to as far away as Indonesia and Kenya, have visited mycommitment.org. They have already committed more than 200,000 hours of volunteer time and close to $130,000 in contributions. One young person committed to working with international students to foster intercultural dialogue. Another committed to collect old laptops and ship them to Ghana. One of my most interesting commitments, and I know this because of the work we do there in HIV and AIDS, a man from India discovered that in his area, the only HIV AIDS prevention booklets available were printed in Hindi, but the local dialogue is Telugu, his native language. So on his own, he is going to translate the booklets and go out and become an AIDS advocate and help the people who cannot even read by speaking to them in the local dialogue to make sure they know what they need to do to avoid contracting AIDS and giving it to others. So that's a terrific, amazing thing. I want to thank MSN for featuring CGI so prominently on its homepage to get the word out about mycommitment.org. We're going to keep this open all the time. We're trying to create a virtual community of givers of all sizes, shapes, and stripes. I'd like to thank YouTube, which helped us to bring the proceedings here to people around the world by promoting CGI on the homepage and hosting video clips of highlights from the sessions that took place here. The videos from the annual meeting were posted on YouTube, including a video, again, about mycommitment.org. They have already been watched, listen to this, by more than 500,000 people. So thank you. In addition to that, all the proceedings were webcast, thanks to the Kaiser Family Foundation for making this possible, and thousands of people followed the whole thing. So we have been able to dramatically expand through the World Wide Web. Next year, we want to expand in two additional ways. First, we want to begin to have meetings in other parts of the world to focus on the unique opportunities and responsibilities there. We will begin in Asia, I believe in Hong Kong next year, to bring together hundreds of Asian leaders from the private sector, government, media, and NGOs. It'll be just like it is here, except focused on Asia. Hong Kong reflects the growing economies of Asia. I think it's a good place to do it. And we'll be able to address local challenges and also global ones that they wish to address. But it will be driven by people there. Eventually, we'll have them in Latin America, in the Middle East, in Africa, everywhere. Now, I think this is important. This would not be possible if we didn't have a primary sponsor, just as Tom Golisano made possible the first Clinton Global Initiative. Our primary sponsors here are Viktor Pinchuk, the founder of the Viktor Pinchuk Foundation from Ukraine, and his wife, who's already been up here, Elena Franchuk. I want to thank them. I consider this a first-class CGI commitment. So, Viktor, I've got a commitment sheet for you. Not that I think you'll back up. Come on here. I want to take a picture. Thank you. The second way we're expanding is to cultivate a new generation of citizen servants and philanthropists. Next year, we're going to have a CGIU, a CGI university. We'll start meeting every year, once a year, on a university campus, interconnected through technology to university campuses, not only across America, but across the world, with committed students who can make a real difference. After all, they have a big stake in this. And I think getting young people into this at an early age is very important. Another thing I'm trying to do is go to as many high schools as possible. Terry McCall's here. I went to his children's school, and I said I wanted every high school in America to have their own NGO. And I just went to one outside Chicago and made the same thing. Just think of it. If every high school in America had its own NGO, and every college in America had its own CGI, and people just did what they could with the money they have and the time they had, it could change the face of philanthropy and the future of America and goodness knows what other countries. So we're going to do that. And so our first one's going to be, appropriately enough, at Tulane in New Orleans, because we're not done there. And it is wrong for us to walk away until we're done. We're going to talk more about it and have the formal launch of CGIU tomorrow evening at the Apollo Theater with Bono, Chris Rock, Shakira, and Wyclef Jean in partnership with MTV. So thank them. Thank you. I'd also like to say I don't want to get into introducing everybody who I haven't introduced, and most of the world leaders have been on panels and other things, but I have to say a special word of thanks and congratulations to Jerry Adams, because this May, the oldest civil conflict in Europe, the Irish conflict, came to an end and proved that it is not a waste of time to spend years and years and years and to be frustrated day in and day out to try to reconcile people across religious and ethnic lines. Congratulations and thank you. Thank you for giving up arms. Thank you for believing in peace. And thank you for making me think that it's always good to take a chance on peace. Now, I'd like to talk about just one other thing. I want all of you to think about whether all the people whose lives you're going to touch in the next year could themselves, once you do whatever it is you're going to do, turn around and become givers. A year ago, through our last meeting, a businessman named Vincent Mai made a commitment to support an education program for children orphaned by HIV and AIDS in South Africa. The organization is Ubuntu. In English, I am because you are. Last spring, at our mid-year meeting of CGI, one of the participants who had benefited from what he did, a young woman named Zaitu, stood in front of us. She was a 17-year-old girl, orphaned, both parents dead of AIDS, two younger siblings. She was supporting them, and in despair about her life, ready to give up on everything, until this program reached into her life and gave her a way to go on and lift her life up and complete her education and imagine that she could take care of her siblings. And so many children in the world are forced to become adults so long before their time. I mention that because this young woman, without being required to do so, felt morally obliged to involve herself in helping others. So she organized her own mini NGO to help 10 other AIDS orphans go through the same transition that she had. We ought to see if we could do that in more places. I think it's very, very important. Giving other people the chance to become givers. After all, you make them feel less poor. You make them feel rich. You make them feel that they matter. That is also a part of empowerment. And I'll just close with this, because again, we're always trying to sort out what's the government supposed to do, what's the business community supposed to do, what can non-governmental groups do, who's supposed to do what, do we have all this mixed up? My strong belief is that in the 21st century, a fundamental definition of citizenship must include a person's responsibility to be a productive worker, a productive citizen, meaning a voter, a participant in the political process, and a productive giver, to be involved in some form or fashion in reaching beyond just those other two roles. If you look at the modern world, at the success of the market economy in allocating resources and creating opportunity, it's obvious that it's not very good at self-regulation at the margin, and it can't solve social problems. So the government has to set up an environment to keep the market system from destroying itself. We've known that at least since the Great Depression of the 30s. And then to take whatever can properly be taken to solve social problems. We also know there's not a single country in the world where the government and the private sector alone have solved all those social problems, because some of them require more personal, more innovative efforts, and sometimes there's just too big a hole between where we are and where we ought to be. That's where civil society comes in. That's where the non-governmental movement comes in. That's where the giving of all of us comes in. And we furthermore know that there are places where we can only solve problems, or we can solve them best, all three sectors are doing something to pull in the same direction. And how many commitments have we seen here that involve the business community working with NGOs, working with a government? So we're all going to have to reimagine what it means to be a 21st century citizen. It begins, however, with believing that it will make a difference to you and to others. Not only it'll make you feel better, and when I was on the Martha Stewart show last week, I met a young woman who's an expert who said there's all kinds of medical research that says if you become a giver, you'll be healthier and you'll live longer. So I don't mind appealing to your self-interest. But you have to believe it will make a difference. That's why I acknowledged our Irish friend here. So I'm going to just end. I'm going to tell you two stories 50 years apart. Last week for me was a very special week, because Hillary and I got to go back to Arkansas for the 50th anniversary of the integration of Little Rock Central High School. Now, those of you of a certain age will remember that. Almost every public school in the United States was racially segregated. There was violence whenever there was attempts to do something. The Supreme Court said that the children who were black had a right to go to the public schools. The governor closed the public schools and called out the National Guard. He was so frightened of nine black kids who wanted to go to high school. The president, President Eisenhower, decided that the Constitution meant what it said and the Supreme Court's order had to be enforced. So he federalized the National Guard and used instead the power of the United States to guarantee the kids access to school. And they braved all this abuse, these nine people, scarring taunts, pushing, tripping in the halls, all kinds of horrible things, to go to school. And it wasn't over. I mean, the next year, the state just closed the school down. They were so terrified of integration. It was a long, bloody siege. We saw a film where these people, now way up in their 60s, were interviewed in high school. And they said, hey, this is not about politics. This is the best high school in the state. I'm smart. I want to go to college. I'm tired of being told I can't become something or another. I want an education. So 50 years later, we're there celebrating it, right? And they're all still alive. And they stood one after the other and spoke all before me. My words were totally irrelevant. They were brilliant in their vivid ability to make the texture of their lives come alive. And what I thought about watching them was, 50 years ago, people like them were invisible to the power structure, and yet they were 50% likely to be smarter than anybody that was dissing them. But they didn't see them. And what did they do with this education? Now, they had different kinds of lives. One went into the military and then later had 10 years of emotional depression because of the trauma she suffered. One married a guy from the Netherlands and became a Dutch citizen. Little southern black girl from Arkansas. One moved to Canada and became a Canadian citizen. One is an educator in northern Colorado. One worked for one of these big New York investment banks, has been my friend for 30 years. One became a professor at the University of Southern California. The point is, they were just like all these kids we're talking about that Gene Sperling's trying to save, or these kids that are dying of AIDS, or these kids whose parents can't make a living. And Lord only knows how many people there were just like them that were just washed off the face of history. And they had real lives. They had triumph and disappointment. They had love and loss. There was real texture to their lives. It wasn't perfect. It wasn't storybook. But it was real because they were empowered by simply being treated like ordinary people. And what did it do for all the observers? That's what I want to say. That's the most important thing. I said that when this happened, it forced people to do more than have an opinion. It moved us from opinion to conviction. Some of my fellow white students, it moved them to conviction in the wrong way, but at least it got the conversation started. You couldn't have just an opinion when this was in your face. It moved us from inclination to action. It moves us from saying, I wish, to saying, I will. That's what I'm trying to do here. That's all I'm trying to do here. I want somehow for all of us to be able to leave here being able to move more people from opinion to conviction, from inclination to action, from being people who endlessly say, I wish, to simply saying, I will. And I never cease to be amazed who says, I will, who steps forward to be a giver under adverse circumstances. So I'll just close with this. One of the nicest things that happened to me in my life since I left the White House is having the opportunity to work with former President Bush in the tsunami and the Katrina areas. And after I did the tsunami work for a while, the then Secretary General Kofi Annan asked me to spend a couple of years trying to just oversee the rest of the rebuilding effort. Just like Katrina, the worst thing about one of these deals is getting everybody else back in their homes. It's just an endless nightmare. And particularly in Indonesia, where most people were just, the largest number were displaced, and the weather is highly uncomfortable most of the time, especially if you're living in the mud. So as the UN coordinator, I had to go back once, and I went to one of these refugee camps just so people could vent their frustrations at me, and I could listen to them. So I get to the camp. And I learned that every camp had elected a leader. So this leader would take me through the camp and tell me what was wrong. So I get out and meet the leader, his wife, and his son. And I look down at this little boy. And by the way, I had a interpreter who had been a young Indonesian television person who then went into this work because she wanted to help her country. So I shook hands with the leader, I shook hands with his wife, And I looked down at this little boy, and I just gasped. I couldn't breathe. I thought this child was the single most beautiful little boy I had ever seen in my life. And I said to the interpreter, I don't know that I have ever seen a more beautiful child. And she said, oh, he's very beautiful. And before the tsunami, he had 9 brothers and sisters, and they're all gone. But here was this guy and his wife there with 1 kid left, more than happy to step forward and be the leader of all the people living in the camp, 40,000 people, with a smile on his face, a smile on her face. He took me through that camp, never one time showed any sense of remorse or self-indulgence. All he wanted to talk to me about was what the people who elected him needed. He was liberated, not imprisoned, by his giving. And he lost a lot more than nearly anybody in this room could ever lose. So then we get to the end of the tour. The last stop on the tour was the health clinic, where they're dealing with all these different problems. And I looked up, and there was the man's wife, a mother who had lost 9 of her 10 children, holding a 2-day-old baby in her arms. The newest baby in the camp, with a smile on her face. And I learned that, because I knew she wasn't the mother of the baby, that she had brought the baby to see me because in their culture, and I'm going to get in a lot of trouble all over the world when I say this, in their culture, when a woman has a baby, she gets to go to bed for 40 days, be waited on hand and foot, and has to do nothing for 40 days. And then... then she gets up and they name the kid, right? But this woman says, we are honored by your visit. This is our youngest child. We want you to name him. So I looked at this baby and I said, do you have a word for a new beginning? And the interpreter talks to the woman. They talk back and forth. And the interpreter turns to me. She said, yeah, lucky for you. In our language, the word dawn is a boy's name, not a girl. The mother says, we will name this child Dawn. And he will symbolize our new beginning. Why do I tell you this? We should not, any of us, have to encounter people who have lost everything. We shouldn't have to walk alongside a man and woman who lost 9 of their 10 children. We should not have to see their courage, their heart, and their giving to follow their example. That's why we do this. To move from I wish to I will. God bless you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for attending the 2007 Clinton Global Initiative Conference. Travel safely. We look forward to seeing you again next year.